Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 5th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's episode, I wanted to give a shout out to those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because I rely on the support of both my advertising partners and my patrons. Those of you who are able to pledge your support week after week, what you do is you offset so that individuals who obviously can't afford to pay don't have to. And I really thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can pledge your support by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy, and you can learn all about it there on that site. This week's top supporters include Mary Neva, Michael Gaucher, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitus, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. Thank you all so, so much. All right, we've got a great show for you this week. I know I say that every week, but it's true every week. And this week I had the opportunity to chat with a dear friend of mine named Dave Farina. You may know him from his YouTube channel, Professor Dave Explains, where he started out doing organic chemistry lectures, but it grew and grew and grew. His background is in chemistry, but he's also done deep dives into physics, astronomy, biochemistry, and so many more important subjects. And he has a brand new book out. I love the title of this book, you guys. It's called Is This Wi-Fi Organic? A Guide to Spotting Misleading Science Online. So if you want to learn more about how to separate real scientific truths from fake news and so much more, without any further ado, I bring you Dave Farina. Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Or should I say Professor Dave?
Well, maybe in the confines of my YouTube channel, I go by that moniker. In the real world, just Dave is fine.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever called you just like Professor Dave when we've been hanging out.
That would be odd. We're colleagues.
Yeah, that would be kind of weird. So, oh my gosh, before we even get into like what's new in your work life, I want to know what's new in your life, you know, for people who are eavesdropping. That's what I like to think this show is, just people eavesdropping on me hanging out. They may or may not know that you and I've been friends for a bit. We met through SciComm camp, didn't we?
Yeah. The talks that you were giving at that place downtown.
Oh yeah. We did these like science and spirits events.
The science and spirits. Yeah. And then, I'm not sure if that was the first time we met, but I definitely was going to those, and then I was going to SciComm camp. So yeah.
Yeah. Super, super fun. And so there's this kind of like LA group of like cool science communicators and science educators who we all sort of know each other. We've all kind of met and hung out. And you are a part of that group. So probably the last time I saw you in person, was it the last SciComm camp?
I think it was the last SciComm camp where you dropped the bombshell and we were all like, oh no.
Like the last ever SciComm camp.
Yeah, we were all quite sad about that.
Yeah. And I think I did your podcast a little bit previous to that.
That's true. Yeah. You had done my podcast probably earlier that year or maybe the year before. I've since put that on hiatus just because like with pandemic, I mean, I wasn't getting enough of a listenership anyway. But then with pandemic, I was like, all right, I got to focus on some other things. But I want to get podcasting going again at some point.
Yeah. It's funny when I've talked to people who have podcasts or who are interested in the podcasting space, there's a way to podcast remotely that some people already had baked in. And then there's a way to podcast in person. My show was always in person, but I had always had a secondary schematic for how I do it if I need to do a remote interview with somebody who's overseas. So it was very easy for me to just adjust to that. But for a lot of people, it's like, no, the whole point is that we're sitting here.
Right.
And that's my whole recording setup is like that.
Yeah, it's less fun, but obviously, given the circumstances, that's what you got to do. I wasn't getting enough traction with it to like go, all right, now I got to figure this out. I'm totally tech incompetent, as I told you. It took me so long to even figure out how to like rig up this microphone to be able to talk to you with some decent audio quality.
Oh, I love your radio. People can't tell, but we can see each other. They can't see us. Mwahaha. Right. But I love your Radiohead poster in the background.
Thank you. That is Instagram ads at work. It's the only thing I've ever bought from an Instagram ad. It flashed me this Radiohead. For people can't see it. It looks like sort of like a vintage sci-fi novel book cover. And it just looks so cool. It looks like the cover of like Logan's Run or something. And it's about paranoid android. And I saw that in my Instagram feed and I was like, I want it. I don't care. I don't care that it's an Instagram ad. I need that poster. It's so cool.
Too many things off of Instagram.
Really? This is the only one, but I was too perfect. I was like, Instagram, you got me. You know me.
Instagram has gotten me a few times. What I usually do, though, is I'll do my research. So I'll see a thing on Instagram, and if it really gets me, I'm like, God damn it, I just clicked on that link. That's going to ruin my feed for weeks. But then I'll like try and find the best price or look at other people who sell it, because sometimes they're like these weird, scammy, like it's coming in freight from China and you don't know when you're going to get it. And
right. Like, I don't know. Take a while. I don't remember. I think I just clicked up, but I could have gone on Etsy and found it or something.
Exactly.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it's like next day delivery. Yeah. I'm like, oh shit. All right. So, but also something else new that has come up in your life is that you have a little bebe.
It's true. It's true. We've got a little boy. He's about 18 months. We're actually sleep training him right now and it's working. So it's a huge relief because he was sleeping, you know, waking up every 2 hours for months and months. And then it got to the point where he wouldn't even go in his crib. So he was in our bed for months and again, like waking up every couple hours and just, it was real tough. It was taking its toll. So now we're sleep training. Last night he slept for 11 hours straight. So we were like,
oh, wow.
Oh my God. It's a completely new. Our lives are different. Like, yeah. We're rested. We have like our evenings to ourselves. It's insane.
But what has it been like? I mean, you know, I have a couple of friends who had pandemic babies.
Right.
So mostly it was a pandemic pregnancy. But what has it been like during those really formative, like infant months raising a baby in lockdown in quarantine?
It wasn't too bad because when the pandemic hit, he was only like 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So like March, right when, you know, last year when it started going down, we were like, well, it's okay. Cause like he's 6 months old. Like, what is he doing? Now it's a little bit rougher just cause like we want to take him to like those kind of like little classes and stuff where he gets to play with our other toddlers. And, so luckily we're almost out of this thing now. So it's not gonna be too bad, but we're pretty lucky. I mean, we're really not that affected. You know, he just a little bit less socialization. He could have been playing with other babies a little bit, but you know, when you're not even 1 year old, like, you know, it's not like he had to be taken out of school or anything. You know, parents with their kids, like parents who work full time and then they have to like get their kids doing their school stuff too. It's like, I can't even imagine what some parents have been going through.
Yeah. And it's cool, too, that there's almost like a silver lining. I've been talking about this a little bit with some of the patients that I work with at the cancer center, where obviously it's like you get cancer and you're dealing with COVID and anything else in your life. And it's horrible. And it's just like everything sucks. And this is horrible. But this one sort of silver lining, which is a bit of a perspective shift that a handful of my patients tend to have, is that thank goodness I could convalesce when the world was shut down anyway. And like I didn't feel the pressures of work, or maybe they did, unfortunately, but maybe they could work from home, or at least if I had to stop working, other people were in the same boat. I wasn't getting like FOMO out there. So like, I wonder when you have a little one, it's like, you know, you get to actually spend quality time with them and you're not being pulled away.
Yeah. Although I have descended even farther into workaholism. So it's a little tricky, but no, I mean, yeah, I work a lot, but I work at home at my leisure. So, you know, I do, you know, I start and stop as I please. So, I can kind of structure it around like, okay, it's time for, you know, bath time and putting them down and, or, you know, oh, we're going to go walk to the park for an hour. And so I'm going to do that. And then I'll work when I get back, you know. So it's been great. I mean, I consider myself in the 99.9th percentile of unaffected by COVID. I just, you know, I sit at home and make my content and actually I got a nice little uptick from people having to do all their schooling at home. So my channel killed it in 2020. I gotta admit.
Love that. Yeah. So speaking of like, you know, all the work that you're doing and all the knives you have in the fire. So do you consider yourself, when people say, what do you do for a living? Are you like, I'm a YouTuber? Are you like, I'm a freelance science communicator? Now you can add author to the list.
Right. Yeah.
But like, how do you define your job?
I say science communicator. I mean, obviously, I focus on my YouTube channel, but I had already started moving into like the realm of public speaking a little bit before COVID, and I was a little bummed. I actually had a bunch of stuff lined up that fell through. So I'm looking forward to probably 2022. I'll start, you know, really picking it back up and trying to be as much of a public figure as possible. That's definitely something I'm passionate about. So the channel will always be kind of the hub probably, but now, you know, with this book and I wanted to get the podcast going again, just really as many ways as I can reach the public and try to help them get on the same page as the scientific community. That's my role.
Cool. So let's talk a little bit about Professor Dave Explains first, like what you do, how it started, and like you mentioned that it got an uptick because of homeschooling. So this is definitely a YouTube channel that even though adults can really appreciate it, it's kid friendly, right?
Yeah, I mean, the content is pretty much aimed at high school and undergraduate curricula. So it's very, it's not so much like one-off topic, like try to grab you. It's pretty much like, here's what you learn in chemistry 101. Here's what you learn in physics 101. And it kind of follows along the standard curriculum. So it's definitely for students. But it's all stuff that I, or not all, but a lot of it is stuff that I would like for all the entire adult population to also know. So right. It's a little harder to reel them in, but every once in a while you do get some people who are like, you know what? I want to not just pretend I understand chemistry. I want to understand chemistry. So I'm going to watch these tutorials, and not kid myself. This is what you learn in school. So if I learn this, I at least partially know what people in school know. You know.
I gotta say, I'm like legit pissed that when I was in high school, YouTube didn't exist.
I know.
YouTube, I would have been such a better student.
Yeah, YouTube came out. Came out, I guess is the best way to say it, the year I graduated college. So, I mean, it didn't.
What year was that?
2005.
Oh, yeah. So it was the year after. I graduated college in 2004. Yeah. So it was helpful in grad school. But by then, it's like, and it was the early stages, too.
So. Right. And so, I mean, you had just those handful of creators like, Sal Khan was obviously the first one to like really, really upload an enormous amount of educational content to the platform. And then he just, you know, he killed it.
And then he's like Khan Academy. Yeah.
Exactly. He's Khan Academy. I mean, it's very interesting. Like, cause I started the channel in 2015 and around 2016 was when I was like, all right, I'm all in on this because I started to look at what had happened on YouTube from around 2007 to around that time. And it just, even though it had been like 8 or 9 years, it still was not like had not reached its potential as a platform for education. Now it's like completely oversaturated. So I'm lucky that I kind of beat that saturation by right. like a year or two. So the algorithm kind of favors me a little bit. I did see kind of a chasm in between these two styles. There was sort of like crash course, a little bit more edutainment, a little more entertaining. And then, with like high production value and then kind of Sal Khan Blackboard style. You would never, ever, ever watch this unless you needed to pass a test. Like, yeah. And there's just nothing in between. There's nothing at all in between. And so I was like, I'm going to aim for the middle of that, you know, stuff that is applicable to students in their classes, but that like you maybe would have a shot at somebody just watching just because they're, a clean aesthetic, kind of crisp and easy to watch, concise, you know, and none of these like hour and a half videos. Like, let's try to do it in 12 minutes, you know,
right?
That kind of
right.
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true, because I do think that there's probably a big fall-off factor. So unless you're really motivated to dig deep into a lesson,
yeah.
and what would that motivation be? Yeah. Either that you're that interested, but more than likely,
right.
you're right. You're,
you gotta pass
you're afraid
the test,
you're going to
yeah.
fail the test.
And even the students, they want it fast. You know, they're like, look, I don't want jokes. I want, give me the answers to my questions so I can do well in the class, you know. So try my best, yeah, to be as succinct as possible, as clear as possible. And just deliver the comprehension as thoroughly as possible.
Okay, so there's a gap there because you graduated college in 2005 and you studied chemistry in college, right? And then you started your YouTube channel in 2015. What was happening during that 10-year break? I know you went to grad school too, but were you also like working in another kind of job?
Right. So I continue to be relatively disillusioned by the potential to be a successful musician. So the short answer is that I was playing music that whole time. I mean, I'll give you the shortest version possible of that 10-year gap. After college, I had grad school attempt number one in UC Santa Cruz. for synthetic organic chemistry. But it was really just an excuse to move to California and play music. So I found a band in Santa Cruz right away. And second semester, they were like, we're moving to San Francisco. And I was like, okay, I'll quit school. Like, that's fine. So I was playing in bands in San Francisco for a while. Then one of them, I moved down to LA with that band and was playing over here. And all the while, I had to like pay rent from whatever, dingy place I was living in. So I would like tutor, substitute teach. And then eventually I got a job teaching organic chemistry at this trade university. And being a lectureship, you do need a master's for it. But what happened was there's a lecture component and a laboratory component. The laboratory component, you only need a bachelor's. So I got that job. I interviewed. They gave me the job. And then on the very first day, the lecturer had this freak out. Like his mother was ill and he was inconsolable and he just left.
And oh my God.
Exactly. So my boss came up to me and was like, you have to go teach the lecture right now because there's, we don't have time to like hire somebody. It's happening right now. Here's the book. Go in there. Go teach. And this was weekend accelerated courses. So it was 5 hours of lecture, 5 hours of lab, Saturday, Sunday. So
Jesus.
I struggled through like 3 hours off the top of my head that day, just doing like nomenclature, whatever. Went home with the book. All right, what am I going to do tomorrow? And I did that. And then it's been all week. What am I going to do the second week? And I just kind of like got through it. And they're like, okay, great job. All right. But the guy's back because his mother's fine now. So, and then the second, and then the next semester, he started doing all this weird stuff again. Like it turned out that he was like an alcoholic and he was just doing really shady stuff. And eventually they fired him and I took over again for the second half. So I did OChem 2 and I lectured, did both a lecture and a lab. And so they're like, all right, you did a good job. We want to give you the course. We want to give you the job, but you have to have a master's. You don't have a master's. So as long as you're concurrently enrolled in a master's program, we'll give you the job. So they kind of bent the rules for me actually paid for it. I was going to CSUN for organic chemistry. Did 2 years of that, finished almost all of the course requirements, was also doing research, which was not really going that well because also in that time I was in a signed touring band that was like actually doing well. And so I was like, well, this is my priority. So I want this job because it pays pretty well for at the time I thought it was like this incredibly high paying job. and I got to go to school to keep that job. So I got to go to school too, but I was in a touring band. And so like, the tours had to happen. And so I eventually lost that job for a multitude of reasons, all of which were bureaucratic. And because I lost the job, they cut off the funding to the master's program. So that was 2013. And I was like, all right, well, that's fine because I'm in this band. And so 2013, 2014.
You were so close.
Well, yeah, I was. But it ended up being okay because in 2015 or 2016, I was like, you know what? I really want to finish because I realized that SciComm might be something that would work out for me because I made this YouTube channel for like passive income. We were in the tour van one day and we were like, all right, we need some passive income because we go out on the road and, the tours pay for themselves. So we're not putting money in, but we all have like apartments at home and like it just sucks not having any money when you're on the road. So we need passive income. So I was like, all right, well, I used to teach OChem. So I'm going to deliver my OChem lectures to camera and put them on YouTube and maybe I'll make some money that way. And that started ramping up as that band was kind of like, coming down, ended up not working out. But so I wanted to go back to school and CSUN wouldn't actually take me back for the chemistry program, which was a bit of a bummer. But they said, why don't you do science communication? So I enrolled in that and I got to use some of the credits that I'd already gotten from the chemistry program as like electives for the science education and just did that program. And so, picked up some things there.
Yeah, I can't imagine that didn't actually help you more in your career now, learning science education. Like, what a cool thing. I feel like I've never taken even a single science education course, and that would have been really helpful for me as a science communicator.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting. I mean, we did a lot of the theory side. So there, we would read Piaget and then like talk about it and stuff. So that part was super interesting. I will admit that the bulk of the program was devoted towards techniques that science teachers could use in the classroom, like high school science teachers. So I was definitely
like pedagogy.
Yeah. I mean, like not just pedagogy in terms of from like a theoretical approach, which I dug because that stuff is like universally applicable. A lot of it
actually
was
physically like experiential technique. Oh, weird. Yeah,
like,
okay.
I mean, like really like how do you use like Google Sites and like Google Sheets to like make assignments and stuff. So like super helpful for all the science teachers, which was everyone but me. I was like the one black sheep. There's like, oh, that's just Dave. He's like a YouTube guy. And like, he's getting a master's in this.
We let him come to class. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, great program. And I'm sure that all of the science teachers got a ton out of it. It helped them like optimize their workflow and like generate a curriculum that they could like use every year. And everybody's just like working off the same like Google sites and Google Sheets and like, you know, using all this different tech. So like super cool stuff, really, really powerful for science teachers. I got out as much as I could. But I definitely, you know, with the theoretical stuff that was helpful, but was mainly just like, okay, I want to wrap up this master's degree.
Right.
You know, just to kind of have one. But
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I got to ask. So I know that you are like a concert level pianist. Like that's the music side of you that I knew. Uh-huh. What were you playing in your bit? Were you like a touring piano player?
No. So I'm a drummer as well. I started playing drums in college. I'm classically trained on the piano from age 8. But around like end of high school, I was getting really burnt out because I was doing competitions and I didn't dig it anymore. And I pulled away. And then I started messing around on drums and it just sort of rekindled everything because I was, you know, just jamming and wow, I can be in bands now. Like, isn't that cool? And I started learning ethnic percussion and just my mind exploded with all this like new musical influence. So starting in college, I was like, all right, it's bands. I want to play in bands. That's what I want to do with my life. I want to play in bands. And so, you know, I don't regret it. I spent the entirety of my 20s and into my early 30s just like kind of assuming that I would be a successful musician. And you know, the last band I was in called The Lonely Wild, we, you know, were signed and touring. And so by many measures, we were successful, but unfortunately it didn't fully, you know, become everything that all of us wanted. So, but luckily I had SciComm kind of already getting going. And so, you know, when that band kind of didn't work out, you know, I still am planning on doing music. So I have another project and I'm trying to get to a place financially where I can kind of not work and fund the art at the same time,
which
obviously requires a monumental amount of passive income. So that's why the last 5 years I've been working so relentlessly at the channel, because it will give me that. That's still the dream. But right. SciComm is a really cool career that I never knew I'd have, and I hope to continue to grow my whole life. So
you know, it's a bonus. This concept of passive income as a freelancer, I think is really interesting to me. You know, I think a lot of times when we think about passive, well, some people are like, I don't even know what that is. Like, right. I don't have to work and I make money.
Exactly.
And then if you start to dig into it, you more think like things like real estate, maybe, mm-hmm. like you have some investments, but usually you have to like be rich. You have to already have money to make money passively.
That's right. Yeah.
But as freelancers, we do have a handful of opportunities, especially content creators. So mm-hmm. kind of maybe help the people listening know what that means and how that works.
Yeah. So apart from like real estate, you it's possible to just invest an enormous amount of your time, which is what I've done. Because so YouTube, I mean, you know, I think most people know this, but if you don't, you get money on YouTube based on AdSense revenue. So YouTube plays ads before your videos. If you let YouTube, you can click a button, say, go ahead and play some ads, and you keep 55% of that money. So they do take a nice big chunk, but it's also just, here, YouTube, make me money. And all I have to do is make the content, put it up there. And
hope people watch it.
And so that's why getting into SciComm was really refreshing for me, because I'm used to being a musician where, you know, I put up videos of me playing, you know, I would make these little concerts at this place in NoHo called Kulak's Woodshed, and they have multi-cam capturing it, look really great. I would do my own compositions. I would do avant-garde renditions of popular songs. And I was thinking, you know, this is like 2011, 2012. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. Like, I'll make my piano channel. This stuff's going to blow up. Nobody cares. Nobody watches it. Nobody wants. I mean, it's just.
I've seen some of those piano videos.
Thank you. But I mean, you know, the view counts are in the hundreds, and they've been up for a decade now. So it's
interesting.
Like, you know, but then with SciComm, I figured out this other angle, because it's students need to, number one, students need to learn this content. And mm-hmm. if you explain it better than everyone else, they'll watch yours.
Yeah.
There's an actual metric that can be used to gauge what kind of content is going to be watched. And second of all, it's the ultimate evergreen content, because every single year there's a new batch of tens or hundreds of thousands of people, or millions, honestly, that need to learn this content all over the world. So the way in that it is passive income is that, you know, I started out, I generated some chemistry content, you know, general chemistry, organic chemistry. Then I did biochemistry, classical physics, modern physics, biology, you know, then just sort of growing from there make the content as best I can, which is very, very time consuming. And at first, almost no money behind it, you know, because it's very slow.
Expensive at the beginning, not terribly, but you still do have to have cameras, you have to have microphones.
That's what's great about YouTube is at least they did just close them down, but they had YouTube Studios,
yeah,
where you could go do everything for free. So I until the pandemic, I had been shooting all my content for free. I mean, I do have to pay somebody a day rate to run the camera and like monitor audio. But we're talking
about...
you're
not having to rent all that equipment and rent the studio space.
No,
all
the gear is free. I paid somebody $250, $300 for like a 12-hour day and just, you know, point the camera and that's it. So I was... really, there was almost no financial investment. It was just an unbelievable time investment. I was working, you know, and still am, but was working 70 hours a week pretty much, doing the content, picking up... content creation, like private contracts on the side. People would see the channel like, hey, make us this content for some money so that I could actually pay the bills, because YouTube wasn't I wasn't making much money. I mean,
because at the beginning, you don't know if people are going to watch.
Yeah. And luckily, the content was received well enough right off the bat. Like with the OChem tutorials, people were like, oh, great, good OChem tutorials, because there wasn't that much on the topic yet. So I got encouraged a lot very early on. And so that prompted me to just kind of like buckle down and put the time in. And now I've amassed, you know, over 1,000 tutorials where if I want to just stop and sit back and just accumulate the AdSense revenue, that will continue to earn me money indefinitely, or at least until YouTube is no longer a profitable platform, which since they're owned by Google, I don't think that the lifetime is, going to be too short. I think they're going to be fine for at least a few decades. So
you don't think it's going to go the way of Vine?
I don't think so. I'd be shocked. I mean, because I get contacted by a lot of other platforms that are trying to be kind of the next educational platform. And, you know, whether they want me to create content, exclusive content for it, or if they want me to consult or something like that. And I just look at it, and every single one without fail, I'm just like, what are you doing that YouTube's not doing?
Right.
There's nothing that you're offering.
And I can watch these videos on YouTube for
exactly.
free.
Exactly. Yeah. And YouTube is the second biggest search engine on the internet after Google. So
it's also why we're comfortable with the fact that, yeah, there's ads. Like that's the, yeah. I'm as a content consumer,
right.
Yeah, I'm going to sit through this ad. Like, I don't love it, but
right.
What do I expect everything to not come with a cost? You got to get paid.
Exactly.
And the way you get paid is I sit through the ad and then I watch your video. And
this
it's
is how
win-win.
I can afford to make this content for the people who need it. And so if you can't afford a tutor, you know, this is, you know, you sit through an ad and you get free tutoring, essentially. Or if you're trying to be entertained, or, you know, everybody knows what YouTube is, and it's awesome. And I have nothing but positive things to say about YouTube. I mean, they've enabled this lifestyle for me where I now do have a pretty enviable amount of passive income that's only going to continue to grow to the point where I am now, I think 2021 or at least 2022, I'm going to start to be able to not just not work very much, but also be able to fund artistic projects. Like, so that's why I've been working so relentlessly for the past 5-6 years, and it's finally come to fruition. So.
Yeah, and also have a family, you
that's
know,
right.
like
yeah.
kids are expensive.
That's right. Yeah, I feel so lucky that, I mean, we had a little bit of trouble having the first kid. It took a few years and there were some other extenuating circumstances. But honestly, I only became financially stable enough to have a baby about 3 months after he was born. So, I mean, it really was serendipitous the way it lined up. Like, honestly, he was born in August of 2019. And I think October of 2019 was the first month that my AdSense revenue exceeded my overhead. So it was more than rent and bills.
Right. In the meantime, you're always having to fill that gap.
Always having to, you know, now I don't take contracts anymore. You know, when they're like, hey, we'll give you this amount of money to make this. No, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. I'm obsessed with passive income now. Like, it, to me, the idea of like tutoring, of like, I work this amount and you pay this amount, I'm just like, why would I do that? I'll work this amount, make this content, and profit off of it for the rest of my life.
Forever.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I finally are able to do that with your back catalogs and podcasting with dynamic insertion. It required a lot. And the people listening are like going, F you, Kara, because now there's these ads that are in the podcast that are like not in my voice. They're like commercials. But that's because anybody who listens to my back catalog now, I'm able to make money off of this inventory that used to be considered dead. Like, it would air. So you would sell a live read ad. This is like the way the podcast world works. And maybe this would be interesting to people who are listening. Maybe they're like, I don't care. but you'll have a contract with an advertiser. And let's say it's, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to say the widget man, and the widget man wants to sell his widgets. And then I go, hey, you should buy widgets from the widget man. He's the best. Go to widgetman.com/nerdy. And I get paid on a CPM, just like YouTube, which stands for cost per mila, which is like cost per thousand, which is weird, but yay Latin. And then I make money, but it's during an air window. So it's either 30 days or, you know, 60 days usually. And then after that, the ad is still there. I'm not making a cent on it. I'm no longer in contract with that person. So the way that the world works now is you can insert that ad dynamically. So there's software that allows you and algorithms that allow you to do that. And once it's done, it gets excised out. And then the company that you're working with drops in just rando commercials into that dead space. And you make a much lower CPM because it's not in your voice, but at least you're now monetizing your back catalog. And
that's
a show
brilliant.
Like mine. Yeah, it
I did
is
not know
evergreen.
That.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Because otherwise, the model of how you get paid doing podcasting is actually pretty limited. And of course, Patreon is amazing. Do you have a Patreon?
I do. Yeah. It's not that heavily patroned, but it is there. And it
helpful,
is a nice
though.
Little extra bit of change. Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, the people who listen and who want to support the work, it helps keep it free. Like, it sort of makes up the difference. And that's why I like that they call it Patreon. Because for some people, it's all very transactional. Like, I've seen patrons where it's like, I do this for you if you help support my show. And for me, unfortunately, because I'm in graduate school, because I work in television, I don't have time to keep doing all these little small things. So I feel like the people listening, and thank you, I thanked you already at the top of the show, and I'm going to thank you again from the bottom of my heart. I always think of it as they help make the content free for everybody else. Mm-hmm. Because they can afford to do that. But I have been thinking lately, an ad-free version would be a nice thing to give you guys. So I got to figure out what that cutoff would be, and then maybe I can deliver an ad-free
feed
for you.
Put that
up
on the Patreon page, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Why not?
Like, the few patrons I have, like, they don't care. Like, I similarly don't want to do any kind of perks that require me to do stuff.
Like extra work. Yeah, it's really
exactly.
hard to fit it in.
But I sometimes do like a little behind the scenes, or like, you know, I just talk into my iPhone, say what I'm working on right now, or, you know, what's coming up, and they don't even watch it. It'll get like 3 views. Crap. I mean, they straight up don't even watch it. They don't care. They're just like, hey, you know, I could have paid a tutor thousands of dollars and I didn't. So here's $1 a month.
Yeah, exactly.
The least I can do.
And we're like, thank you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it adds up. I mean, obviously it does not come anywhere near my AdSense revenue, not by, you know, an order of magnitude or more, but
that's interesting.
It's a little bit of extra that what are you going to scoff at free money? I mean,
yeah. And the funny thing
appreciated.
Is the quantities are so different in different platforms. Like, I've never been a YouTuber because I was way too late to the game, and it would have been, I knew in my heart of heart, I'm friends with too many YouTubers and know that part of the reason that they're as successful as they are is because they're incredible. And part of the reason is because they got in early. Yeah. And so I just know that I missed that curve. But podcasting, I got in, you know, sort of at a good peak. And I would say that I make the same amount of money with ad sales as I do with my Patreon. It's about 50-50.
Yeah, so that's really more common with a lot of platforms. Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, it's really interesting.
It's just YouTube. Okay. Just it, like, it just blows my mind. Like, do you ever go to socialblade.com?
Mm-mm.
So it's just a website where you can look at any YouTube channel and you can see what they earn, how many views they're getting. Like, you can get like rough estimates of their stats.
Amazing.
Yeah. Oh, it's
I'm doing it right now.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time on there sometimes, you know, analyzing myself, but also and that was initially in around 2016 what prompted me to go all in on the channel, because in 2015, I just threw some content up there. I didn't even look at what was on YouTube. I didn't care. I was like, here's some OChem lectures. Let's see what happens. And then when people were like, hey, do more, I was like, all right, what do people actually earn on here? And I started looking up kind of more popular channels on Social Blade, and I mm-hmm. could not believe how much money they were earning. Seven figures they were earning on AdSense revenue. So I thought, well, look, I mean, even if I don't get that, you know, to that level, there's got to be a way to like for me to make a living off of this thing. And I'm going to work hard until I get there. It was a 5-year plan, but here I am 5 years later. And I kind of don't have to work if I don't want to, you know. So it's pretty.
You're so right. This is
pretty sweet.
YouTube is crazy, Dave. Yep. Like I'm looking at your. I just, of course, looked at your channel here, and you have. You're coming up on 1 billion views.
You've got 94.
Oh, you're right. I can't do math. Let me pick that up then. Jesus
but,
Christ.
That's, you know, BYT give me job. Another.
Let me make a note here. I'm gonna take that again. not in the chat, in the footnotes. Edit out billion. Yeah, because I'm like, billion was like, TYP is the only place I know that did that. Okay, here we go. So I'm looking at your stats and you're coming up on 100 million views. You have well over 1 million subscribers. And the crazy thing, like you're doing so well. And the crazy thing is your rank is still like that. Like there's still thousands of people who do as well as you or better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the incredible thing. Like 1 million subscribers used to be this incredible achievement. Now there are tens of thousands of channels with over 1 million subscribers. I mean, there's really a lot. But if you look, I mean, sometimes I look at the absolute tops, like I look at some of the like children's channels and they're getting like several billion views per month. I mean, it's they're making eight figures. They're making eight figures on AdSense revenue. Then don't even, you know, ask me about like their sponsorships and like the brands they're working with. And then then they sell toys and then, you know, so. Children's channels, but I mean, even the top educational channels are really raking it in. So, I mean, that's what got me thinking, like, look, I got nothing else on my plate in 2016. I'm like 32, I'm broke, I got nothing to show for myself. I'm going to do this until it's good and is you know, doing well for me. And so that's why I've been working like an insane person for that long.
And thank goodness you have a kick-ass wife who supports that as well.
This is true. This is true. Yeah. It's come out in her favor as well.
Yeah.
So she knew what she was doing.
Okay. So as busy as you've been, you also wrote a freaking book. Let's talk about this because this is something where I'm always impressed when people that I know, friends of mine, especially when I know them personally and I know how many knives they have in the fire and I know how hard they work. And they're like, oh, guys, I also wrote a book. And I'm like, how? I don't know how. I can't imagine. I'm that person who says when people are like, do you like to write? I'm like, I hate writing. I like to have written.
Right, right.
I love having written.
Yeah, I feel that way about music. It's very difficult to sit down and write, but I'm always very proud when it's over. I'm going to be, unfortunately, one of those people that you hate because I found it to be a very easy process.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. It's just that. So what happened was around the holidays 2019, this small publishing, publishers, Mango Publishing, reached out to me. They had become kind of in the habit of reaching out to relatively large or up and coming YouTubers to see if they want to write a book. And I thought, well, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I had an idea or two. And so I kind of explained my conception of, the concept of a book. And they said, sounds great. Start working on it. And so I wrote it in about 2 months, not even really full time. But the thing is, it was a lot of talking points that I'd been kicking around for a while. So I had given this talk on, pseudoscience and public perception of science a bunch of times, and I had sort of refined it over several iterations. And so I mined a lot of talking points from that. And then I chose some other topics and it just kind of all came together as like a merging of the two things I do on my channel, sort of the academic tutorials. So like kind of explaining the basics of these scientific fields combined with like the debunking activity I do. So going after hoaxes and con men. And honestly, just like really innocent misunderstandings of like basic scientific vocabulary words. And it just sort of, I don't know, it happened pretty quickly. So
I love that. And I love the title. Is this Wi-Fi organic? That's so funny.
Yeah. So that is interesting. I lifted that from Bobby Moynihan. Do you know his drunk uncle character on SNL? It's a classic character, so everybody should go check it out. It's absolutely hilarious. It's, I think, the funniest thing Bobby Moynihan has ever done. But what happened was I was doing kind of a brain dump, you know, when you do, you know, you're trying to name a band or you're trying to get a book title or something. I was just sitting there and doing like 100 book titles. And so they would have like toxin or chemical or snake oil. And I was just dumping, brain dumping. And that one came out, said, is this Wi-Fi organic? And I was like, that's really funny. did I invent that? I don't think that I invented that. And then I kind of, then it became clear to me, oh, I saw that on Drunk Uncle. But I gave it to the pub. I gave my list of like my favorite 15 or so to the publisher. And they're like, is this Wi-Fi organic? That's funny. We're going to use that. And I was like, okay, full, you know, disclosure. I ripped that off of somebody. Is that okay? And they're like, that's totally fine. It's not going to be a problem.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? Mm-hmm. Like when I first started in media, I remember saying once to a boyfriend of mine, like, talk nerdy to me. And he was like, I love that. We should do like a thing around that. And it ultimately became my HuffPost channel, which ultimately became Talk Nerdy. The reason my podcast is called Talk Nerdy with Kara Santa Maria and not Talk Nerdy to Me is because HuffPost owned all my IP when I left.
Oh no.
And so I changed the title to be more, but it's so funny because people all the time still are like, did you see this t-shirt? Did you? And I'm like, you know, I didn't invent that phrase, right? I'm not like the first person who ever thought to say talk nerdy to me.
Yeah. Luckily you can't copyright phrases. So
yeah, exactly. So you can use them.
But you know, it does, yeah, it ended up going well.
It's funny that you talk about that process being so quick because, you know, for the people who listen to the show with the crossover from my work on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, obviously this is going to be like, oh, put it in your cart. Like, we got to buy this book, right? This is hook, line, and sinker what we talk about when we talk about scientific skepticism. And when we wrote The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, you know, full disclosure, Steve Novella, the main author and the host of the show, did the bulk of the heavy lifting. He divvied up some chapters for me and Jay and Bob and Evan. But Steve, same as you, it was like 2 months, I feel like. He wrote the whole damn book. And I was like, how is this possible? And he was like, it was already in my head.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an articulation of something that's already in there. You know, I have a lot that I want to say to the public about, you know, this is something that the public is misunderstanding. And I feel like I know why. I not only want to point out this way that the public is perceiving this word or this topic is wrong, I want to help them understand. I want to diagnose it, right? Why does the public not seem to grasp what like natural means or synthetic or organic or toxin or theory, right? Why are these words being used improperly? I think, you know, they stem from these false analogies or these other connotations that the public doesn't separate them. And so I try to elucidate all of that in the book in the hopes that somebody could say, oh, I thought natural meant good, synthetic meant bad. Yep, that's why. That's why I thought that. Now that I know why I think that, I don't have to think that any longer.
Right, sort of getting to the root. Like, it's interesting because there are a few kind of landmark scientific skepticism books and, you know, new ones sort of come out periodically. Some of them recapitulate old ideas. Of course, we have to. Like, these are important kind of core concepts that we've got to revisit.
And still problems.
Some of them, they take a slightly different approach. Like with SGU, we took the approach of like really digging deep into what we called neuropsychological humility, understanding sort of the evolution and the neurology and the psychology of things like cognitive biases, you know, confirmation bias, like digging into that. Sometimes we've seen these Hallmark books that are put out by like magicians who will talk about why it's so easy to be fooled. That's a very common tack. But I love that your tack is one that's like really kind of about media literacy. It's about like existing in a modern era, which I feel like a lot of the scientific skepticism books that are on every skeptic's bookshelf, they're a bit dated.
Yeah,
they definitely don't really speak to our generation, you know?
Yeah, because it's a twofold problem. So, I mean, part of it is the public not having the basic scientific understanding. So, I do try to address that, and I do try to go, all right, here's like the basics of chemistry in 15 pages. Like, this is just as simple as it gets. Like, please just understand this about chemistry and then biochemistry, biology, physics. So I try to get that out of the way. But then I want to apply that to different hoaxes and con men and show the common thread there. So you know, the common thread, number one, they're all anti-establishment narratives. So there is sort of this bias that a certain population of people of the public has regarding authorities or perceived authorities. So this could be a government or an industry or a corporation or the scientific community, which is insane that somebody would be like, oh, the big science, you know, it's just kind of ridiculous.
But you know, we hear it all the time.
They think that way.
Big green energy, climate, yeah. Big climate.
Yeah. Exactly. I understand it because number one, we've been wronged by authority figures before. So it's not insane that we would think this way. But when people identify with that narrative so strongly, they become very, very easy to trick because anybody can come along and say, oh, big pharma, blah, blah, blah. And then they just buy it. They just buy whatever they say.
And that's sort of that transition from misinformation, pseudoscience, kind of like latching onto non-science into conspiracy thinking. Like that's correct. The way we go down the rabbit hole.
Correct. Yeah. And there's many layers to it, right? I mean, like I do have a lot of sympathy for like chemophobia is another big theme of the book.
Oh, like something's made of chemicals, so it's bad?
Yeah. An irrational fear of chemicals and chemical sounding things, like to the point where people would ask something like, are there any chemicals in this? Well, yes, it's literally all chemicals, just like everything else that you can see.
Everything that is made
of the chemical elements. I mean, the only things that is not chemicals is like, you know, light and neutrinos and, you know, those kinds of things are not chemicals, but they don't have any nutritional value. So,
if we break down chemicals enough, we get to those subatomic kind of particles, not to light, but yeah.
But I mean, so that can be very innocent, sort of just this like little bit of fear or paranoia, but then it gets ramped up very quickly when you have people, not just con men, but also the entire alt health industry, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry that exploits chemophobia, exploits distrust of Western medicine, et cetera, to sell things. And so, you know, I want to try to make
participants every step along the way, right? You've got the people who are like agenda driven, who are nefarious and know it. You've got the people who are on the bandwagon and they may believe what their bullshit. Yeah. Right. Or whatever. And then you've got the people who are hooked by this and who are taken advantage of.
Exactly. And so if I can show people the anatomy of the deception, hopefully that can help them become undeceived. You know, the people who are criticizing the money, the financial motives of, you know, any large industry or corporation, which let's face it, that's how capitalism works, are not considering the fact that the alt health industry is itself profit driven. And very, very dishonest at that. So, you know, I think we need to help people see that. And
the David and Goliath narrative, you're right, exactly. Kind of underlies a lot of this. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like big ag versus small-time farmers. And so we think of the organic industry as like, oh, it's just grandpa and his farm, but it's really against Monsanto. And that's
there's
the
no science in this food. That's what people want. They want food with no science in it, you know. But I mean, organic is the perfect example of a buzzword that it truly does not really mean anything.
Now there are legal definitions, but you're right. It didn't really, and definitely not natural. That means literally nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing is, it has these legal connotations, but they do not correlate whatsoever with health or, you know, anything that's going.
Or reality.
It does mean specific things, but number one, people don't know what it actually means. People will think that it means, say, no pesticides, right? Well, no.
Actually, they just have to use more dangerous pesticides.
Exactly. It is true that oftentimes they are more dangerous because they're not regulated in the same way. And so, I mean, even just the fact that, yes, they are using pesticides because they're farmers. This is how that works. But just getting people on board with these definitions so that we can diffuse the power of a buzzword like organic. Or toxin, or things like this, where they're not only misunderstood, but they're weaponized against the consumer, you know.
And because once we do understand that, we can actually be empowered to have better purchasing power. Like, I often think about, for example, when we think about GMOs, one of the biggest arguments that when I start to break down where people are coming from and what it is they don't like about GMOs, it's actually that they don't like monocropping, or that they don't like patenting certain types of sequences in food. They don't like the idea of owning the concept of a food, like a patented food, which still happens in conventional agriculture all the time. So there's this idea that they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But the actual fundamental function of what's happening to develop a GM plant, usually when you demystify it and you use different language, they're like, oh, that's a great idea.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, anything that requires millions of dollars of research has to coexist with the patenting process. Otherwise, nobody would invest the money into the research. But I mean, obviously, you know, GMO stuff, it's a complicated issue. And so I'm not an expert on it. I don't pretend to be. But the way that you can approach it is the public perception of this issue has gotten so insane and so detached from reality that you'll find products in the store like non-GMO salt.
Yeah, you can find something that says sodium chloride.
What does that mean? It's not an organism. It does not have genes. It does not have G's to M. It does not. What is this sticker doing on this product? Like, it's absolute insanity, but it's there for a reason, because people want to see that. They want to see the organic sticker. They want to see the non-GMO sticker. They want to see the sticker that says no science in here. And that's just like, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be able to analyze and critique every single little nuance of GMOs or, you know, genetic engineering in agriculture. I'm sure there are legitimate criticisms and I'm vaguely aware of some of them, but I it's just not my place to go way into the weeds there, so to speak. But just this generalized hemophobia, that's what we need to work against. Because if we don't have that, if we're all speaking on the same level here, and we all understand like what DNA is and what it does, just this basic high school information, then we can all talk about these other more nuanced issues. We can talk about them together and make decisions together that are informed.
Right. You see that a lot. Yeah, you see that a lot, like with the GMO argument, where I've even seen some polling data. I don't know if it was Gallup, but some like pretty legitimate polling data where it was like, you know, GM versus non-GM, what's the difference? What does it mean? And people are like, oh, well, GM foods have genes and non-GM foods don't have genes. And it's like, right. To us, that's hilarious, because we're like, what? Like, how do you not know the basic? But of course, gene, DNA, like you said, RNA, like these different words, kind of they carry a connotation. They can sound a little scary in the era of CRISPR. And like you mentioned, I love this about how like non-GM salt, like, yeah, clearly this is sodium chloride.
It's just baking soda or something. It's insane.
Yeah, but people don't realize that it's just as insane to see like non-GM, I don't know. I got to come up with some like non-GM asparagus. It's like, yeah, because there's no GM asparagus. Of course it's non-GM. There is no legally traded GM asparagus. Like there are only something like, let me see. I have it here. Like corn, soybean, cotton, potato, papaya, squash, canola, alfalfa, apples, sugar beets. And I think there's this new banana that's being developed. That's literally it. Nothing else is GM. But because so much of our food is made out of corn. Yeah. Or soybean, you see it in a lot of processed food.
I think another issue is just kind of the romance that people apply to agriculture. I think a large portion of the public seems to be under the impression that all of the stuff in the produce section at the grocery store just came out of the ground that way.
And that
and I don't think people really appreciate the artificial selection process that humanity has undertaken over the past several millennia to make plants look that way, to make vegetables and fruit look that way on purpose.
To make them, their fruits larger, to have more sugar, to have more nutrition, to have more carbohydrates in them. Yeah, you look at corn, you look at old tomatoes, they're all shriveled and
kale, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, all these different vegetables are all derived from Brassica oleracea. It's a wild mustard plant. And if you look at it, it's not even edible. I mean, it's disgusting. It's a ridiculous thing. But through selective cultivation, we've literally invented all of these things. So, you know, this idea that just like nature is wonderful and healing and all this magical stuff comes out of the ground and it's perfect as it is, it's just complete fantasy. I mean, people have this tendency to think of nature as like only healing, but nature is pestilence and natural disaster and death and destruction and all these things. You know, it's
nature
it's
is COVID. Yeah. Nature is the black plague. Nature,
if you believe
is,
in COVID, of course. Yeah. So
I got to ask you then, yeah. How much do you hate Gwyneth Paltrow?
Oh, man. I'm going to do a debunk on Goop at some point. It's tough. I'm just kind of like working my way through a lot of different... There's just so much to debunk, so it's hard to know where to start.
But that foundational thing that you mentioned about this idea that like nature good, I do think is an underlying thread of almost everything that a Goop style proselytizing falls back on. It's this cognitive bias. Nature good. Synthetic, you know, scientific bad.
Right. That's 100% true and a big, big focus of the book. I mean, those two words in general, natural and synthetic, right? And so this ties into what I was saying before. I want to try to diagnose the origin, right? So I think that it's really just false connotation. So like there could be some substance like a fabric or something where if you have a synthetic fabric, it might be imitating a natural fabric. I don't know a lot about fabrics, but like, you know, you've got like wool or cotton. And then you might have this synthetic fabric that's like a little itchy or, you know, but these are different substances, right? On the molecular level, natural and synthetic, right? We're just talking about the routes that are taken to get to a molecule. So nature builds molecules. We build molecules. If it's that molecule, it's that molecule. So the properties of the molecule don't depend on whether nature made it or we made it, right? It's just a molecule and it does what it does based on its composition and shape. And so people who think that like, oh, it's a synthetic, you know, I would never take synthetic vitamin C. Well, it's vitamin C, right? Vitamin C is vitamin C. This molecule is vitamin C. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, your body doesn't know the difference. And it's the same with GM, right? There are different properties that are intentionally induced to make GM crops. Like we want to make it disease resistant, or we want to make it have a longer shelf life, or have a brighter color, or a richer flavor, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and still with an additional nutrient like the golden rice or, you know.
Right. Or it's, you know, we used a gene from another plant that had an intrinsic ability to fight off a certain pest. So we put that gene into this.
Which enables us to use fewer pesticides, by the way.
Exactly. That's why we mostly do GM. Yeah, exactly. But the funny thing is that what people don't realize is that from a cellular perspective, from a tissue perspective, those two slices under the microscope look the same. Your body processes the same. Your body does not know the difference between the GM version and the non-GM version. The only way you would know the difference is if we bred it to have a phenotypic change, like it looked different to us.
Or if you sequence the genome, which...
Or if you sequence the genome, which, come on.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I do have a little bit of sympathy. I mean, because, you know, molecular biology is not that simple and you have to understand chemistry first. But we did all learn this stuff in ninth grade. I mean, we didn't understand it that well, but we did learn it. We learned transcription and translation. We learned DNA, mRNA, to, you know, protein. Well, like we did learn.
Yeah, it was on the test.
It was
you
on
took
the test.
That test.
We all took the test. And so I get that obviously most people are not going to retain everything that they learned in high school, and that's fine. But we need to do these little refreshers. And I like to try to offer these little refreshers of like, all right, here's a year. Here's all the most important things of ninth grade biology in 12 pages. Just read these 12 pages. This is what you need. More would be better. But you need this, please.
So, well, and what an important kind of extension that you've got. You've got the YouTube channel where you're doing that. You're saying, here I am, I'm going to help you pass the test. Even if you don't have a test, you want to remember, you want to dial back into this foundational knowledge because it's fundamentally important. And then why is it important? Hey, check it out. Is this Wi-Fi Organic, a guide to spotting misleading science online? Now I know how I'm utilizing this knowledge. If not for this knowledge, I wouldn't actually be able to have a bullshit detector.
Exactly.
I wouldn't have a good filter, and
you
I would
fall
be
for
duped.
Con men. Absolutely.
Totally. And people are left and right all the time.
All the time being duped. I mean, that's the thing about the internet. We thought, many of us thought it would be this great equalizer and everybody would have access to all the information. And it's true, they do. But there's just now so many people that want to exploit people and have an avenue to exploit them and have a medium with which to reach all the people that they can exploit.
You're right. Like so. We will always naturally, as much as something becomes democratized, there will always be these natural gatekeepers that work their way in. And we are a species that cannot process that much information. We need experts. We need curators. We need individuals who we can trust, who can take those shortcuts for us, because we can't be expert in everything ourselves.
Yeah. And that's why an attack on expertise is the strategy of the con men of late, because they need a way to get people to doubt people who actually know what they're talking about. So that's why it usually ends up in conspiracy, because it has to, right? Why are scientists wrong? They spent their whole lives, figuring this stuff out. They know what they're talking about. But wait, no, they don't, because they work for big whatever, big this, big that. And so you can't trust them, which is insane because, I mean, you know, take any field of science. There are hundreds of thousands of people all over the world that work in this field. And there's no, I mean, anybody can become a biologist. Anybody can become, you know, a chemist or a physicist. You majored in college and then you go to grad school and then you're one. Like, there's no eyes wide shut sex party second year of grad school where they're like, okay, now you're going to be part of the shill crew and like you're going to sell all these. It's like, it's just some 22 year old kid that's like, I like physics, you know. It's just insane the level of conspiracy that they have to resort to in order to discredit expertise, you know.
I think about that with things like, you know, UFO conspiracies, where it's like there's this requirement for like an intergovernmental cabal where we're all trading secrets but keeping them from the public. Or exactly. I saw this a lot around COVID being a hoax. One of the earliest arguments that COVID was a hoax was that it was like to keep Trump from getting elected. And I was my response was always like, you realize that like other countries exist.
Right.
And people in those countries are also sadly dying of COVID.
What do they care? Yeah.
I know. It's like, it's such a weird, narrow perspective. And it requires.
Quite egotistical.
It so is. And so like nationalistic. Just, you know, open your eyes a little bit.
And I mean, with the UFO stuff, it's like, I'll entertain that a little more because we're only talking about secrets. Did a UFO come or not? Well, probably not. But if so, it's a secret. It doesn't defy the laws of physics. Whereas you take something like COVID denial, and you know, I'm not talking about like, oh, China manufactured the virus or something like that. I'm talking about people who deny the germ theory of disease. People who think that viruses are not real. This is insane. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. I mean, I just want to start from the bottom and at least take care of these lowest tiers of just like, it is insane that you believe this. Like, let's please not be insane. If you want to talk about, did China manufacture the virus? Okay, like at least we can talk about something there. You know what I mean? It doesn't defy physical reality for you to believe that. But
and the sad thing is that oftentimes it's not as clean cut as we'll bucket it, because from the perspective of a science communicator, it's like, okay, so everybody who denies X falls into that bucket. But what I see a lot of times, and the reason it's so insidious, and I can speak to a person from my life who's a very, very public person whose name I won't mention, but anybody listening might be able to get this dog whistle, that there's this portion of the population that's like, I'm not anti-vax, but I don't deny germ theory, but, and then they have this weird rhetoric around the body is a swamp, or the body is like a pond. And if I keep my body healthy, then my own immune system will do the job. But if I leave my body like a swamp based on what I eat, then all of a sudden I'm going to be, you know, falling victim to disease. And it's this disgusting way to basically put the responsibility on the victim. I see this a lot with like cancer. I see this a lot with, you know, like, oh, it's because you didn't eat enough. It's because you didn't pray enough. It's because you didn't keep a positive mentality, which is disgusting and morally bankrupt. But it's also a way to feel sort of like it perpetuates this, I don't trust these, like you said, these authority figures. I don't trust these institutions. It's up to me. And the only reason we're sick now is because, you know, General Mills is feeding us processed sugar.
Yeah. And I mean, they can always rely on like instances from the past where people have gotten the short end of the stick. And, you know, I understand the sentiment here, but it's like there are scientists, like scientists don't all work for the government. Do people not understand? There are scientists who work for the government. There are scientists who work in the private sector. There are scientists who work in academia, and they work in all the countries in the world. And there's a consensus amongst them which about things that are verifiable by anyone. If you don't agree, then you can study that field and you can see for yourself if you want. It's all here for us to all, you know, that's the denial of reality when it gets to that level, like viruses aren't real. Well, really, because we can see them in electron microscopes. So what is that?
I'll show you a picture.
What are you talking about? You know, we sequence their genomes. We use them in techniques like gene therapy. We use retroviruses. Like, it, you know, it's just that level of denial.
It's like denying chairs. There's no such thing as a chair. And it's like, no, but there are chairs. You're sitting in one. It's like, but I don't believe that this is a chair. It's because you somehow are keeping your eyes closed, or you've redefined it as something else, or you're using some sort of other mental juju. And to your point, about the fact that, like, not all scientists work for big pharma, not all scientists work for big oil, not all scientists work for the government, I think a lot of people get confused too when they see that something is NIH funded, or they see that something is, you know, has national academies. Like, they think, oh, this scientist was funded by the government, so they're a government scientist. When what they don't realize is, no, this scientist was funded by you. They were funded by your tax dollars. They got a grant because the government is where our tax dollars get held and then processed to then be given back to us. And so there's a big difference between working for an institution and applying for a grant to an institutional gatekeeper and saying, I want some of my own money back so I can study how to cure cancer, so I can study how to make healthier food, because I want to serve my country. And this weird idea that the government, especially in a representative democracy, is somehow not also just a conduit for the people's voices is really bizarre to me.
Right. Yeah, it's such an unbelievable oversimplification to go, oh, the government has lied before, so everything from the government is a lie. It's just, it's really intellectually lazy to resort to that kind of a narrative.
You know? And again, we're not living in North Korea. We're not even living in China. We're not in a place where we have a totalitarian government. We live in a representative democracy, and there are obviously big abuses of power that happen. There are obviously situations in which, unfortunately, disenfranchised people or oppressed people get mowed over. But to lose the fundamental understanding that our government is made up of the people that we put there and we can take them out too is kind of sad.
Yeah,
it's really sad.
That's a whole other kettle of fish. Yeah, getting people into the political process. But
right.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Because we do have to, like, you know, look at these instances where these complaints are valid, and we need to elucidate them and educate people on, okay, this is what, like, corruption is inevitable. If you have a multi-trillion dollar industry, there's going to be corruption. I don't care if it's banking or healthcare or agriculture, whatever it is. When you're throwing that much money around, there's going to be corruption. So instead,
and when you
of
have
just,
a capitalist system or a socialist system, I mean, there's corruption in all of them.
Yeah. And in particular, the brand of capitalism we're currently engaging in. But it's just like, you can't, like, you know, okay, are there problems with healthcare? Yeah, there's problems with healthcare. There's problems with health insurance. Of course there's problems, but you don't throw the whole thing away and then go rub a crystal on your back. Like, you don't, like, this is
what?
On your head or wherever, whatever hurts.
I saw your okay.
On your genitals if you want. I don't care what you do with crystals on your own time, but you don't throw the whole thing away for its faults. You try to understand it and you try to improve upon it. You try to regulate it. You try to, you know, weed out the bad apples, and you try to make it as best you can, you know? So that's where the basic education comes in.
It's so true. You try to protect the consumer because you are the consumer. And the truth is, I would much rather consume vetted and regulated, you know, produce, vetted and regulated medicine, vetted and regulated clothing, vetted and regulated knowledge, than living in a place where it's utter anarchy. Can you imagine? And it seems like that's what a lot of people who fall victim to these kinds of, you know, pseudoscientific or even in the extreme version, conspiracy thinking, that seems like what they're advocating for is anarchy.
Which is insane, because I don't think people really appreciate how damaging it is to have something like the alt health industry that is truly unregulated. And so, like, I talk about this in the book a little bit. It's like, can you imagine, like, if big pharma I don't even like to say big pharma, just if a pharmaceutical company said, hey, we've got this drug that cures heart disease, And but by the way, it's a sugar cube. Don't tell anybody. It's actually a sugar cube. That can't happen because there's regulatory bodies in place that would prevent something like that from happening. But that is the norm in alt health. Like homeopathic remedies are nothing. Like they're little globules that may as well be sugar cubes. But that's
on the good side. Yeah. On the good side, they're nothing because by definition, homeopathy is just water.
Exactly.
But on the bad side, it's like, oh, homeopathic teething drops and it's got belladonna in it,
right,
or it's got some sort of harmful
to
active
you,
ingredient. Yeah, it's like, oh my, and again, unregulated. Can you imagine, for example, if in the midst of COVID, Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca said, we're developing a vaccine. We're not going to tell you what it is. We're not going to test it. We're not going to do anything, but don't worry. Just trust us. It'll help.
We
and
found
then put it out
in
there.
A tree somewhere. So it's good.
We think it might work.
Yeah.
We're not going to actually do any good science.
Yeah.
We're not going to get it peer reviewed.
Oh,
we're not going to ask anybody for their insight.
It only works if you believe it works.
Right.
If you have bad vibes and you don't let it in, then it won't work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then what, I mean, can you imagine?
It's just insane. Yeah. I mean, so, but again, you know, the alt health industry has grown so huge that they are able to fuel this narrative of distrust for the scientists, for the regulatory bodies, for basically anything standing in their way, that would denounce them as legitimate. And, unfortunately, huge swaths of people fall for it. So.
Yeah, and prey on people in oftentimes their most vulnerable states, when
for
they're
sure.
the most desperate for treatment, when they're, you know, strapped for money, when the, you know, legitimate things that they've tried might not have worked, or they haven't been doing it long enough, or they're like, let's try this other thing first because I'm afraid of chemotherapy, I'm afraid of radiation, and then it's like too late because the disease has been growing and spreading, and it's just heartbreaking. You're
it
right.
Is.
Yeah, it is.
It's
real
it
world consequences to these like these fundamental scientific concepts, and how important that you're kind of bridging the gap on both sides. Well, Dave, we've been talking for a while. I don't want to keep you all day. I know you got a baby you got to attend to. I was hoping I could close the show out with you by asking you the same big picture questions that I ask everybody at the end of Talk Nerdy.
You got it.
All right, we're gonna get the kind of hamster going in the wheel now.
Okay.
Thinking deep. Okay. So I want to know, in whatever context is relevant to you in your life right now, so it could be personal, it could be professional, it could be global, it could be cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that's been keeping you up the most at night, the thing you're most concerned about, most worried about, you know, maybe even cynical about, you know, not looking good. But on the flip side, so that we do end on a positive note,
okay,
what are you most excited for, hopeful for, looking forward to?
So I am a very cynical person, so the list of cynicisms could take an hour. But yeah, I mean, I think in general, it is a pretty tumultuous time. And I recognize that I'm a little bit in the trenches with this stuff. And I do put out the debunk content. I do get in the weeds in the comments section. And I interface with all these people. But it is very discouraging, the way people are being manipulated and the way they refuse to take responsibility for their worldview. And it does worry me because I'm not really sure where technology is headed for the rest of this century. There are alarming advances that if we aren't like kind of all in ownership of them as a species, we will be manipulated and exploited. And, you know, it's already been happening with, you know, on the web and taking information. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm not that web savvy, so I can't even really fully articulate it, but I do understand a little bit of the conspiratorial bend on that side. And, you know,
yeah, when people with a lot of power, not a lot of regulation, and sort of the smoke and mirrors are capable of owning something that kind of where we have to give something up to them, that's a really dangerous game. You're right. And
yeah,
so we have to be empowered to be
right,
democratic,
like,
about how we approach these things.
I don't know what Bezos is planning, right? And it makes me nervous.
Exactly.
But so I guess the thing that keeps me up a little bit is just like, I don't believe that we will descend into a totalitarian state, but to think that we absolutely cannot would be naive. And it is a fear in the back of my mind. So I just, that's where I get the sense of urgency of like, you guys, we need to be on the same page, because if we're all on the same page, or at least as close to it as we can, then we can kind of unite and fight these nefarious intents.
And we know that when individual citizens are empowered with knowledge, we've seen this time and time again in countries where women were not allowed to learn. And when we improve knowledge among women, we also improve income, we improve the birth rate, we improve infant mortality, we improve, like, so many things change in society when people have access to education and when they're empowered by their own knowledge.
Yeah, I'm hoping that as the third world starts to become technologically empowered, that so many people, that if they can kind of get on the right side of things, that the sheer numbers will begin to tip the scale in the favor of the masses, you know? So that's why I didn't know initially in forming my channel that I would be helping the third world, but I get so many emails and comments from people in, you know, Africa and Asia. They're just like, I have no books. I have no teachers. I'm learning this.
Yeah,
so,
it's incredible.
Yeah.
So Thank goodness for the democratization of the internet.
Exactly. So it did work out in our favor in a lot of regards. There's just, I think it's a net positive. I think that the internet is a net positive. I may be a naive optimist in saying that, but I do stand by that. I think that that's true. So to flip it over to what I'm kind of excited about, I mean, I think we're all pretty excited that we're seeing the end of the light at the end of the tunnel here with COVID, and I got my first jab this week. So,
yay! Which one did you get?
Moderna.
And so, did you have any side effects?
My arm hurt a little bit of soreness. Susan got it as well, and the second one for a day was pretty nauseous. But so hopefully, well, we'll see. I don't care. I'll be nauseous for a week. I don't give a crap. You know, I mean, I just, it's great. Like,
first jab, soreness. Second jab, brutally ill, but
brutally
still
ill?
Worth it.
Oh, no.
I got brutally ill. Yeah. And it wasn't even nausea. It was much more like flu-y. Like, my teeth were chattering.
That
I had, like, bone pain and my teeth were chattering.
The silver lining of being sick as a workaholic is it's the only time you allow yourself to stop working.
Right.
So if I get 3-4 days on the couch watching movies, if I feel like crap, then, well, at least I get to relax.
And the funny thing, Dave, is that you have this, as somebody who, you know, understands the basic chemistry, the basic biology, the basic immune system and what's going on, it's the weirdest experience where you're cognitively aware that you're like, this is an immune response to a trigger from a vaccine. I'm not actually sick in the sense that I don't have a bacteria, a virus, a protist that I'm trying to fight off. This is intentional and it's induced, but for all intents and purposes, my immune response, my inflammatory response is the exact same. And it's so bizarre because you're trying to talk yourself out of feeling bad, yeah, but you're like, no, I still feel really sick.
Learning about autoimmune diseases and stuff. I'm actually doing immunology content right now. So I'm like learning.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool. All right. Well, everybody, the book is This Wi-Fi Organic? A Guide to Spotting Misleading Science Online. And of course, the channel is Professor Dave Explains. Dave, thank you so much for joining me. This is so much fun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.